Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the State of the Bay Conference in 2006. I know some of you were probably here when we did this in 2003, and a few of you may have been here when we did it for the very first time in 1993. I certainly wasn't here for that one, but I've been working at the ESTRO program. In fact, the last State of the Bay Conference was basically my first job when I got hired, I think, interviewing in this suit. I got hired and came in, and they said, welcome to the program. Put on a conference in a couple months. So I know that time around it was basically my only project, and it took 2 months. This time around, I'm the director, and it seems to be one of about 20 projects, we did it in less than 2 months. So I don't know if that's good or bad. We'll see. I really am glad to see so many folks here today. The reason the Estuary program is here and the reason that the Bay is still in such good shape is because we have such a wonderful and dedicated community of people that care about the Bay and have been working to protect the Bay for decades, literally decades. Tomorrow we're going to be honoring some of the folks who helped get the Estuary program going more than 10 years ago now. I'm going to do just a brief introduction. The other thing that's happened in the last 3 years since I started here, these are my twin babies. Well, they're not quite babies anymore. I had to put them in somewhere. And when you come to the next conference in 2009, because we're doing these every 3 years, we'll see what they look like at age of 4 and a half instead of 1 and a half. I just want to do a brief introduction before we jump into the speakers and kind of set the stage a little bit. I think there's a great Chinese curse that says, you know, you will live in interesting times. And I think we definitely live in interesting times. And you can think about it at the global level. We live in an age of extinction, one of the great ages of extinction, looking back literally in the fossil record. There's thousands of species disappearing from the planet. And we live in an age when we seem to be changing the climate pretty dramatically, and that's something we're going to hopefully talk about a little bit today and tomorrow, how that may influence us locally here. When you look at the Morro Bay watershed coming out from this global picture, I think it's an incredible microcosm. It's the smallest of all the national estuary programs, and I love that, and I love working in it and talking about it because it's such a great example on a relatively small scale of what a community can do and how we should manage our resources. We have in this small watershed, we have urban areas, we have rural areas, we have wastewater treatment plants, we have power generation, we have local economies, tourism coming in and out. And we have it all on this scale that's actually small enough for us all to get together in this room and at the estuary program's regular meetings and working with the university and working with the agencies and actually form a plan, which the estuary program did, for how we can take care of this place and sustain the resources here and still make use of them. And we're actually making some really exciting progress on that plan, and we're going to be talking about that for the rest of today and tomorrow. Our first session is going to talk about sedimentation, and for the folks who've been here for any length of time, I'm sure you've seen the bay changing. I mean, the bay is literally filling in. The drive when you cross over Choro Creek as it comes into the bay looks dramatically different than it did a decade ago, and dramatically different than a decade before that. We used to have salt marsh all the way up to there, and now it's a willow forest. There's no salt water up there basically at all. The bay itself has gotten dramatically shallower, and our first set of speakers today are going to be focusing on this issue of sedimentation, how we're studying it, what we can do about it. And with that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Jeffrey Haltner from Philip Williams & Associates. Jeff has been involved in helping us study and understand sedimentation in the bay and erosion in the watershed back at least in the late 80s. And I think has been now at three of our State of the Bay conferences, three for three. So thank you, Jeff, and welcome.
Well, good morning. This is really exciting for me. This is year 20 for my involvement in the Bay, and I have to say I have the opportunity to work all over the West Coast on estuaries and coastal and watershed issues, and And this remains my favorite place to work. I feel like the community here has probably been more involved and more interested and worked more cooperatively than almost any other place that I work in. So today I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the work that we've been doing over the last 20 years. Those of you who have been at the previous ones of this will see a few of the same slides, but hopefully I'll be able to offer you a little more. And I just put this introductory slide in for a lot of talks. You guys probably don't need to hear all this, but what I like to emphasize about Morro Bay is that it's really the only significant estuary over a reach of about 230 miles of the coastline. Going north, you pretty much have to get up to Carmel River mouth and Elkhorn Slough area before you get a significant area of intertidal wetlands. And going south, really the next really significant one is down at Magoo Lagoon. There are some significant ones around Santa Barbara, but pretty much a rocky coastline. And so that's one of the things that makes Morro Bay so special and I think so important. What I'm going to talk about this morning, I want to cover some different topics. I want to cover initially, I'm going to give you sort of introduction to estuaries 101. So I want to start off with a few slides that just give you an overview of how I look at estuaries and the work that we've done. And then I'm going to go through a sequence where we talk about assessment of problems or changes, what's been going on in terms of data collection, and then how we analyze that data and try to interpret it, and finally then how we turn that interpretation into management action. So that's the sequence that we're going to cover this morning, and you'll actually get sick of it because I'm going to show you the same slide about six times. But I think it's important because this circular process is how we should be doing management of our resources. So we track how they're performing, how they're functioning. We collect data, we analyze that data, and based on the data that we have and the changes that we see, we make management decisions, and then we go back into a continuous round of data collection, assessment, and management decisions. So this continuous loop, and I'll show you how we've gone through that about three times in the last 20 years. Regarding my introduction to ecological processes and hydrologic processes, one of the things that's really important when you look at ecosystems is to understand different spatial scales. And you have to, when you look at a system, you have to be thinking at all of these different spatial scales to actually be able to interpret what's going on. And so at the largest scale, the landscape scale, we want to see how the Morro Bay estuary fits in and is affected by its location along the coastline. And on this really large scale, it's probably particularly important to bird migration and things like that, but also in terms of sediment processes out on the coast, sediment transport to the near shore zone and littoral transport back and forth. Going from there, then we need to understand the bay in the regional context. So how does the bay here affected by the near shore zone in Estero Bay and within its two major watersheds, Choro Creek and Los Osos Creek? So we need to think at that scale as well. Within that scale, then, we can kind of think at the estuary and the watershed scale. So we need to think about Choro Creek, how it performs, and then the bay itself, how the bay is changing on an entire bay scale. And then we can go down to another level of detail, and we can look at the reach scale. So this is the work that we're currently doing on the Choro Creek at the Ecological Reserve. So this is several reaches of creek here. And then you can look within the bay. You can look at the back bay zone. You can look at the intertidal marsh zone. And so each one of those has its own studies. And you can continue this process. In other words, we can look within this reach of the creek. We can look. I'm going to pull this out and sort of hold it so I can talk. But then we may want to know what's going on in this particular reach or this particular reach. We may want to know what's going on in individual slough channels. So we need to think about different spatial scales. Same way we need to think about different temporal scales or time scales when we're looking at changes as occurring. And so one of the things that when we do modeling or analysis, we have to understand what's the time scale at which processes are changing, and then what is the time scale at which our model talks about them. And so if this is sort of relative scale of change going in either direction, I put the estuary down here and the watershed up here, we have things that are occurring, and this is sort of a logarithmic time scale here of a day, a month, a year, 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years. And so we have changes that go on a daily scale. Down here in the estuary, we have the diurnal tide, 25-hour tidal cycle. Here we have our major rainstorms that may be a 1 to 7 day rainstorms. So they occur, you know, in a very short time scale. They don't change things a whole lot. They're part of what the gradual change is. And then on sort of a longer time scale, we have what's the seasonal freshwater input from the watershed to the bay. So we have our wet season and our dry season and variations there, and that has effects on water quality as it comes into the bay. And likewise, we have seasonal salinity changes in the bay going from primarily or very salty during the summer to more of an estuarine condition during the winter. And likewise, as we kind of go on an annual time scale, we have our annual sediment budget for the bay, how much total sediment did we get into the bay each year. So we have big years and small years. Likewise, same thing on the watershed scale. As we go into longer periods of time, then we have our wet and our dry years, our drought cycles, our very wet periods, our El Nino periods, and we have sort of the gradual changes that these kind of effects then are actually having a longer-term effect on the estuarine morphology and how the shape of the bay is changing. Finally, at our longest time scales, we have climatic changes that go on, and we have the effect of those either on sea level rise or in the watershed on precipitation patterns. So we have to ask ourselves then when we want to understand each of those time scales, we do modeling and analysis at each of those time scales. So if we're in the watershed, we may do rainfall runoff modeling in a very short time frame, a week, a day, a big storm. Likewise, the hydrodynamic modeling that we do in the bay where we have these numerical computer models, those operate on time steps of several seconds, and maybe we run those for a few days or a week at the most. But what we're really interested in is long-term changes in the bay. So we have to ask ourselves, how does this help us understand these processes? Okay. Just as a quick overview of estuarine processes, and I'm not going to go into this too much, but as I mentioned, estuaries are particularly interesting and unique because they act as an edge system. So we have an estuary, it's affected by the offshore processes, the watershed, and then its internal processes. And so in each of these zones, then we have things going on that we're interested in that have an effect on the estuary, and so we have to understand it, how it's affected both by the coastal processes and the upstream watershed processes. And I'm not going to go into that in too much detail. So now I'll just tell you a little bit of the story of Morro Bay since my involvement in it. When I got involved in 1986, what I found was that there were really good maps of the bay, a really good map of the bay done in 1874. There was a pretty decent map of the bay done in 1919 and a decent map of the bay done in 1935, and then nothing since then of really any significance. NOAA kind of mapped the main channel so that you didn't run aground, but the bay as a whole was not mapped. So the first thing we did when the Coastal Conservancy got involved and said, hey, let's look at Morro Bay and see what's been going on there, was we said, oh, we need a map. So we went out and worked with a guy from the USGS and did a bathymetry map of the bay. We took some cores. We surveyed some cross sections. We analyzed that by plotting up our cross section. So this was our 1884 cross section. This was our 1988 cross section at one location, another location, and another location. And what we found very interesting was that the main part of the bay was obviously silting in. It had come up several feet. While the main channels actually appeared to be getting deeper. And there were some subsequent studies done, a nice study by Don Asquith, where he actually looked in great detail at the slough channels and said, yes, indeed, that the slough channels are getting deeper. And that was a little bit of a puzzler for a while. But then I realized that this is really the way salt marshes form. Salt marshes start out as mudflats with relatively few channels, and then over time they gradually raise up, and then on the ebb tide, as the water is concentrated, it starts carving channels. And so the process is the main part of the mudflats are rising, but your channels are getting deeper. And then we did some work with, in the old days, we used planimeters, which were interesting little instruments that no longer anybody has to use since we have computers. But we looked at the volume of the bay, the total tidal prism that goes out in and out each day, and we found that it had gone from around 6,700 acre feet down to a little over 5,000. So it represented somewhere between a 20 and 25% decrease in the life of the bay over that 100-year period. And that was actually, when you think of how long an estuary should last, that was a pretty big change in a pretty short period of time. And so we wanted to try to get a handle on what was actually going on, so we put together a sediment budget for the bay, and we looked at all the different ways sediment can get into the bay, including that coming in from Charles Creek, Los Osos Creek, blowing in from the barrier beach, and then littoral transport in and out of the bay. And we did our best to pull these numbers together. I would actually love it if somebody would redo this study, because we didn't have that much data to go on, and it's a pretty important analysis. But what we found is that by far the biggest sediment input is the amount of sand that's washed in and out of the mouth of the bay each year. But more or less, that's pulled out by dredging on a periodic basis by the Corps of Engineers. So this is more or less balanced. And so it doesn't require, or it doesn't result in too much net change, and most of that sand deposition is up in here, in this zone. And then what we found was that the watersheds bring in somewhere around 40,000 cubic yards a year, the barrier beach blowing sand about 8,000 a year. But the bottom line was that over that 100-year period, the bay was filling in at a rate of about 37,000 cubic yards a year, our net inflow. And that number on its own, just as an amount of coming in from a watershed, is not particularly high, but because the bay is such a perfect sediment trap, it has a lot of implications for us. So that was enough to say, hey, we ought to do something, get started on that, and that was kind of the early on process when they were just trying to get a state estuary program going, and it was mostly a lot of volunteer-run activities. But one of the great things that happened at that point is I was staying with my friend John Mino, who owns a big ranch up here, a nice ranch. And he said, oh, that Dom and Ghini piece of property is for sale down at the bottom. And I said, whoa, that's a nice piece of property. And this is what it looked like back in those days. And the elder Dom and Ghini had passed away, and the family needed to sell that piece of land. And the Conservancy was willing to purchase it, so we were able to acquire this on fairly short order. And its location in the watershed, whoops, I didn't want to do that. Now I screwed up. Can I make that go away? Wait, I'll go next. Wait, let me see. Ah, I have to do it. Sorry. Oh, I see. Okay. But basically, we were able to acquire that piece of property, and its location at the bottom of the watershed makes it ideal as a place to trap sediment. The stream, Choro Creek, had been pushed over to the hillside to allow farming of this. It has historically flowed down the middle of this piece of land. So we thought, you know, and this had been starved of sediment for about 50 years. So by acquiring it, actually it just happened that about the time we acquired it, we had the Highway 41 fire, which burned a significant portion of the Choro watershed. And that next year, we had a massive amount of rain. It was one of our wettest years ever. So that combined produced a huge amount of sediment. So we just quickly were able to notch these levees. And then during that winter, we actually trapped several hundred thousand yards of sediment in our very first year of operation. We then went back and actually laid out a restoration plan. We created a pilot channel where the Choro Creek had gone historically. We removed the levee and then kind of stepped back and said, well, let's see what nature will do. And nature very quickly said, well, I like that location where I used to be. So it shifted the channel actually in the very next winter all the way back and has then reestablished itself in its historic location. We've had tremendous growth. The RCD had taken over management, implementation of planting programs. A lot of the willows just came in on their own, but they've done some really nice larger riparian tree planting. And this project has really been probably one of the biggest successes, I think, in the state in terms of restoration. But we didn't stop there. We continued then the next round. By this time, the National Estuary Program was going. They initiated new rounds of data collection. We looked in much more detail at the watershed and the various watersheds. The Estuary Program had it flown with LIDAR and is looking at restoration in the watershed. And so we started looking in much more detail about where the sediment was coming from, different locations, and we could show then that in different parts of the watershed, here up on the headwaters or here down in the lower channels, we had different kinds of erosional processes going on. We looked at how much sediment was coming from those. We also started doing some detailed bathymetry in the bay itself. This was done then as part of the National Estuary Studies on the bay. By this time, GIS had been invented and computers, so we could do a much nicer map of changes in the bay. So we developed this was our 1884 map, our 1988 map. And when we overlay those and look at the differences, then we can actually identify in great detail where how much sedimentation we've had in different parts of the bay. And what you find is that the Chorro Delta, Los Osos Delta, and then the margins of the bay are silting in the most rapidly. We then developed a one-dimensional long-term model of the bay, and with that we could try to predict how long, what fraction of the bay might remain at different times from the out into the future, looking even forward 1,000 years. We could never quite figure out how to define the bay. That was our biggest problem, so we actually gave two definitions, two different elevations. But the bottom line is we showed that this would the bay would fill in on the order of 400 to 1,000 years, but it would be very nonlinear and would happen very quickly at first. It was also non-uniform throughout the bay, so we could expect very rapid changes here in the back bay, for example. So we expect the back bay to be filling in the most quickly. Again, based on that, the NEP program has been looking at management options, and you basically have three choices here in the bay. You can do nothing. You can control the amount of sediment coming in, or you can work in the bay and say, let's just scoop it out of the bay. Those are your basic choices. We did a fairly detailed study of watershed management in the bay, and we said, what can we do in the watersheds to control the amount of sediment that comes out? And so we identified a whole range of practices that can be matched with those different locations that I showed you earlier of sediment erosional processes. And then we looked at the different types of treatments that could be done and over what time frame they might be effective. So some are effective very quickly. Others take a lot longer to be implemented. So you want to have in your watershed management different practices occurring on different time scales so that you have a continuous amount of effectiveness. We also looked at how these were consistent with the National Estuary Master Plan program that had been developed. We also tried to apply cost to each of these practices. This was actually fairly difficult. So we kind of came up with a low estimate and a high estimate and some kind of a range on a per acre basis. And you can see if you don't know what you're doing in life, you just give yourself a really big range there. But we did put together some programs, and what we showed was that you can actually, depending on how aggressive you're willing to be, and so these represented 75% control, 50%, 25% in current conditions, we predicted how much of the bay could be maintained out into the future. And so it definitely shows you that aggressive watershed management is an effective tool. On the other end of the scale, the National Estuary Program is now working with the Corps of Engineers to evaluate the possibility of saying, maybe we should do selective dredging in some areas to try to get ourselves back closer to our more natural conditions in the late 1800s. And so this is a very effective way to remove sediment, but it does tend to have larger impacts associated with it. So that's a trade-off there that has to be considered. So just a few concluding observations. Bay has lost about 20 to 25% of its volume over the last 120 years. Most of that net change is occurring in the margins of the bay, and the net change is occurring from watershed-produced sediment. And we're now in a position with climate change of really dealing with uncertainty, and I'll talk about that just a little more at the very end. The one thing I can say is that as you consider your various management actions, what you're looking for are wise decisions. You're trying to find actions that will give you benefits regardless of things happening that will give you the most benefits over time. And so the one nice thing about watershed actions is they represent good stewardship regardless. They're good for the watershed, they're good for the bay. And so that's one of the reasons I think that they're so attractive. But it doesn't stop here, and one of the exciting things when you look at your program today, you're actually going to see and hear some speakers today talking about really incredible ways of doing data collection, and there's some really smart people now coming onto the scene, and I'm glad I'm leaving. One of the great things, I've been doing this for 32 years now, one of the great things about being one of the first ones to do it is you don't have to be all that smart to make a good contribution, and then over time people get smarter and smarter, so you have to get out of the way. But what I wanted to conclude with is that one of the interesting, really interesting facings of our next generation is this issue of climate change, and that could have real huge impacts on the Bay. So one of the things, I always try to find the good side of things. I'm trying to think of the good side of sea level rise. Well, one of the good things is it drowns the Bay again, so you don't have to worry about all that sediment that's come in. So that may solve your problem right there. Unfortunately, it's going to be kind of a mess, and so we did a little bit of assessment about what sea level rise might do, and in terms of it's going to move the barrier beach in, and the traditional rule of thumb is for every foot of sea level rise, you get about 100-foot inward migration of the barrier beach or a beach, so you can expect the barrier beach to move in. The bay will get deeper and want to be coming in this way. The people of Morro Bay and Los Osos probably won't like that, so they'll probably build seawalls, and you'll start ending up having levees and seawalls. And you see that all along the coast already. That's the way people cope with sea level rise. And what'll happen is the delta will then start drowning again, and it'll go back towards intertidal mudflats. But one of the really nice things about the purchase of Chorro Flats, for example, I mean, one of the things I've always loved about it is that it gave you this continuous corridor from an open ocean to a barrier beach to an estuary to a tidal marsh to willow to low willows and high riparians. This is one of the few places in the state where you still have that kind of a continuous ecosystem. And so that acquisition was really a brilliant one on the part of Morro Bay area and the programs. But this actually could, over time, depending on how much sea level rise, I mean, the lower parts of Chorro Flat are about 9 feet above sea level. The back parts are about 20 feet. Well, traditionally, we've been kind of expecting about 3 feet of sea level rise as being the best estimate over the next 100 years. But, there are scenarios that could say you could get as much as 20 feet of sea level rise within some time frame. But the great thing is you actually have a place for your ecosystems to migrate inward. So that's the kind of a decision. When I talk about wise decisions, it's the kind of thing I think that really is a forward-looking and a wise purchase. So. That's the end of my talk. I appreciate your attention, and I did want to just acknowledge some of the people that have supported this work over the years, but particularly I wanted to say one of the joys of working in Morro Bay is how well the stakeholders and landowners and various parties have worked together, and I think that's really unique along the coast, and that's something that people are going to be proud of. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeff. We're going to have two more folks talking about this issue, and then we are going to have some time for questions to all three folks at once at the end. So if you could remember your questions for Jeff, and we'll come back to them in just a minute. I'm excited to introduce our next speaker as I manipulate the computer. Let me just do this first. Dr. Dean Wendt is a professor at Cal Poly in the Biological Sciences Department and has just over the last year or two been working really closely with the estuary program and becoming intimately involved with Morro Bay issues and politics and stakeholder groups, some of which I think is to his liking and some of which has been exciting in a new realm for him. I'm very pleased to have him presenting this information today, actually on behalf of some fellow professors, Mark Moline and Rick Kvitek from Monterey Bay. He's going to be talking about fitting right in with what Jeff was talking about, this cycle of data collection, analysis, management actions. We have an exciting new round of data collection for Morro Bay that Dean's going to be presenting here. Dr. Wendt.
Thanks, Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I want to thank Dan right off for inviting us to talk about some of the work that we're doing. I'm directing a new program called Slow Sea, which is we've got our logo right here, and it's really a program that's designed to get basic scientists out of the ivory tower and into the community and working with the stakeholders and the community to learn about the Bay. And so there's going to be a session later this afternoon where Dan has graciously given us time to tell you about the variety of projects that we're doing. And I just wanted to say that you know, Jeff's mentioning how well this community works together, and there is no doubt that is due to a large extent because of the efforts of the Estuary Program. And we've certainly benefited from their work. So I'm going to be telling you about some new techniques that are being used to look at bathymetry and habitat distributions within the Bay. This is work that is being conducted in collaboration with SLOSEA and then these other entities, FERI, which is the Florida Environmental Research Institute, CCOR, which is a consortium of CSU campuses doing ocean monitoring on the California coast, Cal Poly Marine Sciences, and then also CSU Monterey Bay, who's doing some of the bathymetry work in the main channel. So without further ado, let me provide you an outline. First, I'm going to talk about hyperspectral and multispectral imagery. This is work being directed by Mark Moline. It gives us information about elevation of the topography as well as bathymetry, and it gives us information about habitat classification. Then I'll spend a little bit of time talking about the multi-beam bathymetry and side-scan sonar work that Rick Kvitek is doing and up at CSU Monterey Bay. And then we're trying to merge these two technologies so that we get a picture of topography all the way through bathymetry of the Bay. And so this is really, I should say, cutting edge approaches to this. And this is hardcore basic science. And we're working out and applying these technologies, and hopefully we'll get them to the point in the very near future so that we can use them to do the sort of traditional assessments that Jeff spoke about earlier. So real quickly, I'm going to tell you a very little bit about the technology and then get into some really pretty pictures. So this is SAMPSON here. You're looking at the inside of a small plane, and SAMPSON is the name for the spectroscopic aerial mapping system with onboard navigation. And here SAMPSON sits. And this equipment allows us to look at 256 wavelengths of light simultaneously and at 75 frames per second. So this is a tremendous amount of information. So every pixel on a picture has that amount of information. And so these flights are flown at about 3,000 feet over the bay. And this contraption is, you've got some lenses I'll show in a moment, out the bottom of the plane. And at the same time, there's an onboard navigation system so that the researchers can pinpoint where that pixel is located within the bay. All right. And so you've got to appreciate we're at 3,000 feet. I'm not. They are. At 3,000 feet, collecting all of this information in a plane that's moving like this and up and down, and they're able to resolve differences, horizontal differences, at 8 centimeters. Okay. So that's about 3 inches. So it's a terrific technology. Here's what you would see if you were strapped to the bottom of the plane as it was flying at 3,000 feet. You could smile for the camera. On top is a hyperspectral sensor, and then we also do multispectral sensing at the same time, which is 3 wavelengths of light, but that gives us some very good information that we're pulling out in terms of elevation and topographic models of the bay. So, but they're both used for doing bathymetry and topography. They just have different applications, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. So here's a picture. This was just a few months ago, the plane flying over. You can actually see the little hole there. Something I didn't mention, we have people who are simultaneously measuring in the water what is being absorbed by the water, the spectral signature, the wavelengths being absorbed by the water. And if you do that, so we have one that's measuring what's the incident light, what's hitting the water, and what's being absorbed in the water, we can actually remove that spectral signature. That is, water looks a certain color because certain wavelengths of light are coming out of the water. This allows us to remove water and get further into the channels because we can remove that spectral signature, and what's left is what the bottom is giving us, okay? And so it allows us to get into the channels a little deeper. We still fly this at absolute low tide, the lowest of low tide, so we can see the most of it. This beautiful image is one that you probably think you've seen before, and you have, but there's a lot of information here. This is a hyperspectral image with 15, I should say, centimeter resolution. I just noticed that. So, you know, on the order of 5-6 inches. And this is, there's a huge amount of information here. This file alone, the native file, is 20 gigabytes of information. And so that's a good portion of a computer hard drive in this one little image. And when they go out and collect, they collect about a terabyte of information. Okay, and so there's the value of that, though, that there's so much information is there's a lot of detail, and we can use that detail to learn about the estuary. So these are, is there any way to turn the lights out even lower? Is that possible? Because these images are pretty. Turn them off. Okay. All right. Woohoo! You don't have to look at me. You get to see the pretty pictures. So this is taking this information here and blowing it up there, here, and there. And you can see the amount of detail. This is just visual. This is just light, all right? I mean, all the wavelengths. So we haven't separated anything out or done any analyses. This is just the native resolution, if you will. Lots of detail. So this is at 3,000 feet, and you can see those pretty channels that are being carved that Jeff was talking about. You can even see, you can see just with your naked eye, different spectral signatures, and those are the different colors. And your eye is not nearly as sensitive as the 256 wavelengths of light that the computer can use to analyze differences. We can go even further. Again, we've taken these little red spots here and blown them up. This is the state park from 3,000 feet. You can see the RVs, terrific amount of detail in the mud flats. You can really see that we probably have a bunch of ulva growing in these little areas. You can get a lot of information. This is just native resolution. What the computer program does is it takes those 256 wavelengths of light, and then it can look for areas that show different representations of those wavelengths of light, different spectral signatures, and then classify these different distributions of organisms or areas. And that's this this is an unsupervised classification. That is, the computer program just did it. We didn't ground truth it, and we have to go through and do that, where you can actually go into the estuary and take the spectral quality of a particular area like the pickleweed and then use that to tell the computer program, when you see this, this is what you're looking at. And what's nice about this is that it allows us now, with this one overflight, you know, that can happen once a year, we can look at the expansion and contraction of different groups of organisms within the estuary. And this is something that the estuary program has already been able to do with multispectral analysis. But we think that this hyperspectral analysis will give us even more information. And I'm going to give you a little insight into what it can allow us to do. This is Humboldt Bay, and so this is a hypospectral image looking at eelgrass distributions. And we can do this with multispectral, and Dan has a data set like this for the bay. But with the hyperspectral, you can take it even a step further. You can look at the different physiological states of, for instance, eelgrass. Because when eelgrass, and you know this when you've forgotten to water a plant in your house, it looks different when it's dying. And the reason it looks different is because the spectral signature is different. And people are using this technology to look at the different physiological states of organisms. And so perhaps in the Back Bay, the eelgrass distribution is at a certain extent, and we can see that, but maybe they're also at a different, they're struggling, if you will. They are in a different physiological state. We should be able to see that and pick that out. So not only what's the distribution, but what's the distribution of healthy eelgrass within the bay. And so that's more of the promising aspects for habitat. And again, this allows us to sample the bay with these overflights that we'll do in one day and then follow the changes of distribution of organisms. Now, we can also use this to look at bathymetry. And this is the really, in topography, this is the real new application of these technologies that nobody is doing right now. This is the color image by the State Park Marina. So this is coming from Choro Creek. That's the edge of the State Park Marina. And this is just an example. We can do this, obviously, for the whole bay. And we've got elevation information. So these are 0.25, 25 centimeter contours, all right, about 10 inches. Between lines, and you can see that we can begin to resolve elevation differences, and we can do this for the whole bay. And then we can overlay that back onto the color image, and you can see which areas are actually, you know, higher. Which areas are higher than other areas in terms of the distribution of habitats and organisms. This is just a really pretty picture that shows the whole area shaded by color for different elevations. So this is the entire image that I showed. And then we can likewise get finer and finer resolution because there's so much information in this one image because they've collected so much information. We can look at, again, 1 meter, for instance, here, contour intervals across different areas of the bay. These are the sand dunes, this area here. You know, this is that same area by state parks. And then we can go in even finer and get even closer and look at more fine scale differences. So this topography and the bathymetry that we can get when we remove the water and in the salt marsh is only half the story. You also have to get into the channels, and you want to see what's happening subtidally. And to do this, we're working with someone part of the Slow Sea program, Rick Kvitek, up at CSU Monterey Bay, and he's using a technique called multi-beam bathymetry. And you may have seen his boat mapping the bay earlier this year. He's also doing getting habitat information with side scan sonar. I'm not going to talk a whole lot about that, but this instrument here allows us to use sound to look at the distribution of subtidal habitats. I'm going to spend more time looking at the multi-beam bathymetry, which gives us very fine scale resolution of bathymetry. And so this is a NOAA chart of the bay. And Rick went in earlier this year and got data for this area here. You can see he followed the channel back as far as he could possibly go. Now, at the same time, we're doing the flyovers, okay, and getting the other information here from the overflights. And so we've got the bathymetry from one technique and then the overflight information here for the estuary and mudflat. And then, as well, the topography from the overflight. And now what we're doing is combining these data sets. And that's where we feel like this is going to be a really powerful technology, that we can take these two data sets and make them into a single map that shows the elevation and topography and bathymetry for the whole bay. And this is a particular representation of those data showing it in shaded relief, and I just think it's particularly beautiful, and it really gives you an idea of the amount of information. So this is the whole bay. Those are all the data that we have at this point. I should mention that these areas, through further analysis, we'll be able to bring a lot of these areas out. We've only analyzed one portion of the information, which has given us all of this out here. And this, of course, is coming from Rick. He can't get into these areas, but we have information from the overflight that will allow us, that we just haven't used yet, that will allow us, hopefully, to get into those areas. This is a little more detail to show you that there is a tremendous amount of detail here. You're looking at, you know, sand waves, individual little sand waves here in the bay. You can see the power plant very clearly. But this is, like I said, here at the middle bay. And then what was that? Here, yeah. Exactly. So the shaded, as it gets darker, you see that's a deeper area. So we don't have a scale here. These images were sent to me 3 days ago. That's how we work. Things I know, I'm trying. But there are real. We can put, it's not that we don't know the numbers. We can put them there. They're just not there yet. The people who were doing this, they already were upset at me, so I pushed them as hard as I could. But anyway, that area, I would say, is probably around, just not from this image, but my own experience, is probably around 15 or 20 feet. It's not going to be much deeper than that. Is it? How much? 30? Yeah.
30 is a real deep hole.
I mean, it's the deepest point in the whole bay.
Well, okay. So this is the power of a community meeting. I love it. You know, you tell the scientists what's up. It's great. I mean, my ego's been battered and beat. It doesn't bother me now. I think that's great. Thank you. So with authority, that's about 35 feet. All right. So, but once we put the scale bar, I'll know, all right? Okay. And here, just to sort of ground truth, you can overlay the NOAA map and see very clearly that, you know, we are finding Black Hill, and our data are showing us that that's the peak, and indeed it is. And here, again, in the Back Bay, seeing Los Osos and the salt marsh in more detail. So there's... there's a bit of work to do here. I mean, these are very new data. There's a lot of work to ground truth this, to find out the exact resolution that we have with these data. That is, we think that we can resolve elevation differences on the order of, you know, 15 centimeters. But we have to go out and actually measure that and check that. But as a tool for monitoring how bathymetry and topography are changing over time, it's very, very promising. And we hope in the next, not long at all, I don't want to promise anything too much, but very soon, we are hoping to be able to go through and do those ground truthing experiments and make sure that we know what we are seeing and what we can actually resolve with this technology. It's only the overflight part just sees a meter or so below when we actually remove. That's about how much water we can remove, and that's where Rick comes in.
Can you repeat questions for people asking?
Yes, certainly. The question was how deep in the water can we actually see? But they weren't supposed to ask any questions. Dan, you told me they weren't going to ask questions. Oh, that's okay. I'm pretty feisty myself. So just to summarize, what will this technology tell us about the Morro Bay ecosystem? As I mentioned, the distribution of habitats to build subtidal, intertidal, and vegetation maps to already add to what has been done, but I think that this is probably an easier way to do it and a way to get a lot of information more rapidly. Distribution and extent of suitable fish and invertebrate habitat, absolutely, we can look at that. It's going to provide us detailed topography of the estuary, the salt marsh and the sand dunes. We can certainly map complex underwater structures. And the big thing is that we can track changes in all of these in things like sedimentation and erosion processes over time. And the bathymetric data, and I didn't mention any of this, the bathymetric data are essential to building really accurate hydrodynamic models. And part of the SLOSI program is also looking at nutrient dynamics. And you can if you're around this afternoon, we're going to have a whole talk about the nutrient dynamics and the monitoring that we're going to be doing in the bay and the system we're going to deploy in the bay here very soon so that we can begin to build things like nitrate budgets for the bay and look at the contribution of the ocean part of the ecosystem, the contribution of the estuary part of the ecosystem, the contribution of the watershed part of the ecosystem to begin to address some of those questions that Jeff showed and brought up. So I just want to end here because signs are being held telling me I need to do so. Dan, thanks for providing us the opportunity to talk to the community. I want to thank my colleagues who decided not to show up, so I had to get up here, Mark Moline and Rick Kavitek. And Paul from Florida, who are really pushing the edges of this technology so that we can benefit from it here in the community. I want to thank my advisory committee, which you'll hear more about if you're around later this afternoon, because this group is really active in keeping the basic scientists on track and making sure that they are providing information that is going to be useful to the management of the bay. Fundings come from a variety of sources, and then my shameless plug, I have a graduate student who's presenting at 1:30 about looking at invasive species in the bay and how invasive species have changed over the last 20 or so years, and so you need to come and listen to that talk. And then 2:30 to 5 will be a session dedicated to the SLOSI program, again thanks to Dan, so that we can tell you a little bit more in a little more detail about some of the other work that we're doing. So thank you very much for your attention, and we'll take questions later.
Thank you, Dean. It's really incredible stuff that's going on in the SLOSI work. Is, you know, Dean's thanking me, but the estuary program, we're just so excited to have this happening here in our watershed, and this kind of renewed partnership and interest with Cal Poly is really going to add a lot to our understanding of the bay and our ability to manage it. Now I get to introduce myself. That's always fun. I'm Dan Berman, director. Our next speaker will be Dan Berman, director of the Morro Bay National Estuary Program.
Don't thank yourself.
Later. I thank myself later. I think we are actually going to have some time for questions, because between Jeff and Dean, about half of my show is going to be real fast, so we've covered it. That's a good thing. Hold for technical challenges. That 20 gigabyte image is challenging our computer. Okay. And we're underway. Jeff mentioned opportunities for working in the Bay itself, and that's what I'd like to give you guys an update on the current status of our study with the Army Corps of Engineers. It was specifically looking at what could we do in the estuary and for restoration work, and I'm going to start with the basics. You know, why would we do this? Why does it matter? Our bay is, we've been talking about the bay shrinking, and I think Jeff has covered some of this, but is it shrinking? Why does it matter? What can we do about it? Why is it happening? And I think some of these are going to be recycled graphics. I don't think Jeff showed this one. The salt marsh has roughly doubled in the last 100 years, and for folks who've been watching from the Elfin Forest, this area has grown again, I think, since 1990 pretty dramatically. It would be fun to repeat this. I think this was just a hand-drawn exercise, but with the new bathymetry maps that Dean was showing us, we could do an even better job of it. And at the same time, the central bay and the back bay has come up, as Jeff was saying, you know, between 2 feet, 3 feet, maybe 4 feet in some places. I know I've talked to people who live on the shoreline in Los Osos who say, I used to be able to jump off the pier at the end of my house into the water, and now, except for at the highest tide, I would land straight in the mud. What caused these changes? That's something we haven't really talked about today very much. And I think I grabbed this off a really interesting presentation by a USGS scientist named Warwick, who was looking at this. And it's really about land use change, but it's really about the 1700s and 1800s, at least as much as it is about what's happening today. When the European settlers arrived here and set up ranchos and started grazing the landscape with cattle and sheep, there was a little bit less of a thought towards responsible land management and more of a thought towards survival at that time. And the native bunch grasses of California are mostly gone. The native grasses that covered our hillsides and our watersheds were very different than the grasses you see today. They're perennial, they're much larger, and they had a much stronger root system holding the soils together. And then I really like this. These are quotes from the late 1800s, after decades of these grazing practices, that Central and Southern California was reported to be essentially a barren wasteland in many cases. There was also some really massive droughts, decade-long droughts in the 1860s and 70s that probably contributed to this. You can read some of these. In 1870, not a blade of grass was to be seen over the Santa Clara. Stock are forced to depend on the scant feed found upon the wastelands now devoted to grazing. Thankfully, this is no longer the case, but the estimates based on some of the work Jeff and other people have done here are that erosion rates starting in this period and moving forward were about tenfold what they had been for the centuries before then. Why do we care? Well, that's pretty easy. One of the dramatic effects of sedimentation of the bay is going to be on the eelgrass beds, and has been on the eelgrass beds. This is a resource that, as we've seen before, isn't seen for hundreds of miles north and south of here. It's critical to the migratory brant geese, who I think are going to be listed this year in California as a species of special concern. And they feed primarily on eelgrass when they stop here on their long migratory flights. The seagrass beds in Morro Bay grow only in a very narrow depth range. They can't survive on the bottom of the deep channels. They don't get enough light, and they can't survive out on the higher mudflats, so they get exposed to too much sun and dry out too much. And so on the left is a bathymetry map of the bay, which we're going to have better ones soon. And then on the right you see a map of the eelgrass distribution. This was from some work we did in 2004. And what you can see is that these light blue areas on the map represent a certain depth range, and that's where almost all of the eelgrass beds are seen. They're on this little shallow bench here. They're back in these little channels. You can see the parallels back and forth. And so if you think about the bay continuing to get shallower, salt marsh is going to grow. The channels are going to stay pretty consistent or even get deeper, as we've heard, and these deeper mudflat areas, these shelves, are going to come up and be lost, and the eelgrass is going to shrink as that happens. If we think about it from a watershed perspective, this is really what can we do about it? Well, I think about it in sort of three ways. We can reduce erosion at the source. We can catch sediment before the bay, and that's like the Chorro Flats project. There's a very similar project on Los Osos Creek that's also been very successful. Or we can remove sediment from the bay. Or we could do nothing, but I think we've all agreed that's not really an option. And we're trying to do, one and two are already happening, and we're going to tell more of that story over the rest of this two-day conference. Just real quickly, this is a stretch of Walters Creek up in the Chorro Creek watershed, and this is pretty typical of a lot of the smaller creek systems is tributary to Chorro Creek. We've got no vegetation, we've got steep eroding banks, and the estuary program working with Cal Poly with grant funding from the Department of Fish and Game and working with the Conservation Corps, this is the same spot a couple years later. We've put fencing up to control the cattle access to the creek. They still come in and use the creek, but they do it for brief periods of time, and it's controlled. The little blue flags are thousands of native plants that we've planted up and down the creek. And then, in this particular spot, we've put a whole bunch of willows in here that are probably three times that big now, the way willows grow. This is another stretch of the same creek. So this is reducing erosion at the source, or at least one piece of it. This is before, right after construction, a year later, and the spring we'll go out and get the 2 year after photos. Chorro Flats, we've seen some different pictures, the same thing. We notch the levees, let the flood spread out and drop sediment out on that. And what it looks like today. So what I really want to talk about today is what we can do in the bay and where we're at with studying that. The estuary program, with some funding from state parks, also through a partnership with the county, started a ecosystem restoration feasibility study with the Army Corps of Engineers. And you don't get to work with the feds without having long names and lots of acronyms. And really, the underlying question is, should we go back and make the bay deeper again? We looked at other things as well, but that was sort of the primary drivers. We can do this work upstream. Can we turn back the clock in terms of the bay itself? Phase one was just getting going. Phase two, we finished in 2003, and it was really a quick look at what happens if we don't do anything. And the answer was that the bay is going to continue to fill in. Eelgrass habitats, at that time they said, could be reduced as much as 50% over the next 50 years. And then phase three is, well, let's look in some detail at options for moving forward. What could we do about it? What's it going to cost? What would the kind of cost benefit be for it? And we've really focused on two main aspects of this. One is actually dredging inside the bay for environmental benefit. And the other is, can we alter the channel configuration so that the circulation in the bay somehow does a better job of moving sediment out? It's sort of easy, I found it was sort of easy in the abstract to talk about, yeah, it would be great to make the bay deeper. And then you get out a map of the bay and you go, where do I bring the big equipment and start scooping? And this was a very extremely crude draft. We were working with the Corps. We said, we know there's going to be major challenges here. Let's just do a back-of-the-envelope version of this to see if something just jumps out and tells us we don't even need to go farther. So we said, well, where are some places that we could dredge? And one of the things, one of the things we said, well, we don't want to destroy the village in order to save it, right? So we said, well, if half of our goal here is restoring eelgrass, we don't want to dredge up all the eelgrass beds in the bay and then hope that they come back in our new version of the bay. That wouldn't be so good. So if we exclude areas where we have a lot of eelgrass, and actually we didn't totally succeed here, but if we sort of exclude some of the central bay areas so that we're not digging up the eelgrass, where does that leave us in terms of places to dredge? One is actually this big kind of sand spit bulge that sticks out into the bay that didn't used to be there. That may be kind of the most appealing from a restoration point of view. And then we started to look, well, we think, you know, feasibility-wise, we have to bring significant-sized equipment in down the channel, so we kind of need to work off the channel. This is an area where there's no eelgrass beds. There's plenty of mudflats and other habitat there. We could dredge this out deeper. That's sort of appealing because the creeks come in there, so it could be kind of a sediment trap. You could have that be a hole and have sediment piling up in there. We could try and dredge some of the back bay where we think a lot of deposition has occurred. We're probably not going to be real popular if we're dredging up in people's backyards necessarily, although some people might welcome it. And when we, you know, we totaled up, it was sort of ironic. We literally kind of hand drew these out, gave it to the Corps, talked about the right depth we would go to, which is not that deep. We want to create sort of a shelf. We were kind of thinking the lower limit of where eelgrass can grow. And they added up all this area, and it basically added up really close to the volume of sediment that we've estimated has piled up in the bay in the last 100 years. And in terms of cubic yards, the volume of sediment, if we did all of this and we dredged all these down to a couple feet below kind of mean low water, we'd be, as we're soaring the tidal prism of the bay roughly back to the 1880 section. Well, that sounds like a good thing. And where do you put the mud after you dig it up becomes a huge problem. You can't just dump it right offshore because it's not sand. It's this really fine clay and silt, and so it's basically treated as a pollutant. If you try and dump it offshore, there's a lot of concern by environmental agencies. The Environmental Protection Agency, which is our big sponsor at the estuary program, doesn't want to let people dump fine mud offshore. In the harbor districts up and down the coast are very familiar with this issue. And so what we would have to do is either take it upland, and there's no easy place to dispose of tens of millions of cubic yards of fine mud upland. You can fill up the Cold Canyon landfill really fast. And so basically we said, well, the best and almost only option is to put it on barges and take it literally 200 miles to this designated disposal site off of Los Angeles, and that's a little expensive. About $70 million, and that's probably like a starting point. That's for like getting the equipment here, dredging, moving it, dumping it up there, and not for a lot of the other work that has to do. When you do these studies with the Army Corps, if we jointly decided to do this, they would pay two-thirds, assuming we could get Congress to appropriate two-thirds of $70 million for this effort. In theory, we could get the feds to pay two-thirds. We'd have to come up with only a third of $70 million. And so there's the fiscal cost, and that kind of off the bat, right off the top, we kind of said, we don't think $70 million is really where we're headed in terms of a feasible project. And then there's also significant other kinds of impacts and costs associated with this. There's going to be a lot of short-term impacts in terms of equipment and diesel exhaust, and, you know, the mudflats themselves are a valuable and rich habitat. And then we don't know that much about how well our newly dredged areas would recover. We'd like to, you know, our vision is that they would be thriving beds of eelgrass, but when you dig down into the bay muds, you can encounter anoxic sediments. You can certainly recognize those by smell if you've ever dug down into the mud a little ways. We're not sure whether eelgrass would grow there. We're not sure how we would seed it and get it started. So there's certainly a possibility we could do this big dredging project, and it could take a long time and a lot of difficulty to get anything growing there again. And then community support is a big question too. Would you guys want to see a massive dredging operation in the back bay? And so all of these things led us, our first reaction was, well, what else could we do? And the next thing we really tackled, we didn't say no, but we sort of said, well, let's set this aside for now and focus on some smaller scale efforts. One of them involves channel configuration. Choro Creek used to flow out this channel primarily to the bay. It, you know, there was the twin bridges, there was kind of a split channel up here, and during high flows it would spread out. But most of the time this was the primary channel for Choro Creek. Around the time of construction of the new bridge and around the time of the big fire and sediment event that we had in the mid-90s, this area really changed dramatically. Sediment moved around, channels moved around. Now, most of the time, almost all the Choro Creek flow comes out this channel and dumps out right here, and here's Los Osos Creek coming in. So all the sediment and water from the entire watershed is coming out right here. And if you think about, at an intuitive level, this was a relatively deep channel, and it connected into this primary channel in and out of the bay. And so, in theory at least, the sediment that's being carried down here hits this, it has a pretty good chance of being carried out of the bay at least half the time when the tide's going out. Now all that sediment piles up right here. It's a much longer stretch out to the main channel. It's a much shallower channel, as anyone who's ever tried to kayak up it at anything but high tide will tell you. And it's both creeks combined. And what we've just seen with our own eyes is that there's been a lot of rapid deposition right here and growth of the salt marsh at this confluence. And it makes a lot of sense. So we talked this through with the Corps and said, well, what if we forced Truro Creek back into this channel, made some changes up here? That would be a almost very minimal invasion and sort of impact to the bay compared to some big dredging. Do a little work up here. Maybe we deepen this channel a little bit. We try and increase the ability of Truro Creek to move its sediments out of the system. And they did a combination of sediment transport modeling and hydrodynamic modeling, looking at the tides moving in and out, different kinds of storm events, and the sediments that are carried in those storm events, and kind of under two conditions, one being the current one being a reconfigured channel. And created some pretty pictures of where sediment would deposit in the bay under different scenarios, how much sediment would deposit. In the end, they said it doesn't look like it's going to make much of a difference, was sort of the gist of a presentation. It was something we received just in August. And by the way, we're also actually predicting less sedimentation than what we had been thinking when we did this more complicated modeling, because they're predicting more sediment moving out of the bay than we had been guessing at and estimating at in past efforts. And so modeling is a critical tool, and it's part of this kind of loop of you collect data, you try and analyze the data, and part of that is modeling and predicting what's going to happen in the future. But you always have to ask yourself, do we trust the model? Do these results make sense to us? And in this case, there's a couple things about their results that kind of put up flags for us. One was that their modeling was predicting, when they sort of ran different kinds of storm events, that big storm events were actually going to be flushing sediments out of the bay, and it was this cumulative smaller events that were going to add to really contribute to deposition in the bay. And just intuitively and based on our observation has been that when we've had really large events, that's when we've seen sudden and dramatic changes. You think about the big fire and the huge amount of sediment that came down in the mid-90s. There was a huge amount of sediment that came down, and there was a die-off in the bay. So much settled out across the mudflats that shrimp and crabs and the infauna were washing up dead. And so we had a lot of deposition associated with the big event. And then the other thing that their model was predicting was sedimentation occurring in the channels and in the delta and not very much in the back bay. If we go back, the closer you get to red, the more sediment. Sedimentation in the marsh makes a lot of sense. That's where a lot of sediment gets trapped. But they're predicting very little sediment accumulating back here. You know, this is sort of the plume that piles up outside the mouth of the bay. That makes some sense. But what we've seen and from looking back as far as the 1880s in the old maps is that the back bay and the central bay are where we've seen a lot of deposition. And so both of these things have led us at the estuary program and the sort of group of folks we have working on this to we're a little skeptical of the way that they modeled it. And it's really a challenging environment to model, and they told us this much, that you can model river systems somewhat, and you can sort of model coastal systems, sort of rivers entering the ocean, but modeling this really shallow intertidal environment is really complicated sort of from a computer point of view. And part of the way they did it was to sort of impose a deeper, more substantial channel through here, because the model, sort of the scale of resolution it works at, it has a hard time comprehending, you know, channels that are 1 foot deep, and that's what a lot of our channels are out there. And so it may be that part of how they modeled the channels is different enough from the way they really are that that's influencing the results. And then the way that, you know, none of us, I don't think, really know what's happening inside these computers. You sort of put data in, data out, and whether the sediment estimates and the way that they're modeling the circulation are, you know, all we can do is say, does this reflect the reality that we're seeing? And so far, we have some real questions about that. So what do we do next? And this is kind of where we're at right now. We can go back to the Corps and ask them to sort of reevaluate their models and try it again. And we've been having some of those discussions with them. It's very expensive to do that. It takes a lot of time and staff on their part. And there's some real questions about whether we're going to get different enough results or whether this is just the scale at which the model will work. We could focus in on this. We could accept the model and say, that's it. It's not going to make a difference. We could focus on this particular project, which is sort of appealing for a couple of reasons. If we look, see, did I get the photo in here? Yeah, it's very much restoration. If you think about restoring, essentially a small piece of this project would be to chop this thing off. It's sand, we can dispose of it just nearby offshore. It would be a relatively inexpensive project. We could dredge it back down and create a big eelgrass bed here. It's a little anticlimactic after this sort of bay-wide effort to say, well, we'll get 40 acres of eelgrass right here, and that'll be the gist of it. We could go back to the back bay, the larger scale dredging, and say there's a couple things we could do. One is to try and round up tens of millions of dollars. One is to try and get a nearshore a site closer to home where we would be allowed to dump the stuff, but that's a multi-million dollar endeavor to try and get a site designated where we could dispose of it closer to home. We could wrap up the study and focus on work upstream. And so that's definitely on the table as well. And I think how we've been thinking about it and how I think about it is that whether this study ever results in a project, it was something that we had a responsibility to do and it was the right thing to do. And you think about it, you know, we go back to this, we've got these three options. We're doing one and two, and the estuary program really felt like we needed to take a long, hard look at what we could do in the bay and really evaluate that in as much detail as we could. And now we're kind of at the point where so far the answers to that are not looking especially promising. There's definitely still some pieces we can think about continuing with. But even if what we do in the end is summarize all this work that's been done, wrap it up neatly and have it on the shelf, and the next time, you know, when someone comes, well, why didn't you guys dredge out the bay? We can go, we spent a lot of time and energy thinking about that, and this is what we got. And if you've got $70 million, give me a call. And Jeff mentioned sea level rise. And he also mentioned, I did want to mention this. You know, we get very excited about changes in the bay. The bay has changed dramatically on relatively short time scales. 8,000 years ago, sea level was quite a bit lower. The shoreline was almost, you know, I don't know, I guess maybe half a mile from this image farther offshore. 3,000 to 5,000 years ago, sea level was a lot higher. So sea level changes on pretty rapid timescales by any kind of geologic measure. And so, which is not to discount the current interest in it and concern about it, but simply to sort of put it in a little bit of perspective. And I think Jeff's description was really important, that the opportunity to have a continuous functional ecosystem and allow the salt marsh, you know, if sea level rise does start happening much more rapidly than it has been, we're still going to have a salt marsh because the habitats will sort of migrate upstream. They'll move as the sea level changes, where in many places you have a salt marsh and then you have a wall and then you have houses. And so as sea level comes up, the marsh is gone. That's not going to happen here. The marsh has somewhere to go. And I think as we consider all of these options and all restoration work, really, you have to really think about first do no harm. And you look out on the bay, and especially in terms of the mud flats, it's easy to kind of go, oh, the mud flats, yeah, we could dredge that up. You think about the amount of life in the mud flats. I like this picture for showing that. There's a lot going on out there. So it would all be, if we were to do something in the bay, it would all be definitely habitat trade-offs of, you know, do we want to sacrifice mud flats for more eelgrass to maintain a kind of diversity in the bay? And with that, I'm going to close and if there are questions, I think we basically have a break from here to 1 for lunch, for posters, and we're going to start back up after lunch at 1 o'clock. And so if folks have questions, for any of the three speakers that you've just heard about sedimentation, now's the time.
Folks, if I haven't come to the microphone here, we'll just take you guys one at a time, I'm afraid.
I'd also like to do one other thing, which is we have some field trips tomorrow afternoon that are happening, and there's still some empty spaces for a couple of them, for a field trip to the ecological reserve under Hollister Peak, and for a walk, a guided walk around the Elfin Forest with some of the folks from SWAP. And so we have sign-up sheets. They're going to be at the table back there. Once these are full, they're full. So if you want to go on those field trips, they're going to be tomorrow afternoon from about 3 o'clock on. And with that, questions for any of us?
Hi. I had a simple question about the sedimentation in and around the new bridge, the twin bridges. It seems to me that that bridge that was placed in there is getting kind of low. And who's involved in that, keeping an eye on that, and how does that affect the estuary?
You want to talk about that, Jeff? The bridge is in city limits. It's a city-owned bridge and city-maintained bridge. The city's very concerned about the lifespan of their bridge. I think it was supposed to have a 50-year lifespan, and it lost about 40 of those years in the first 3 years after it was built. It's already reaching a point where real high flows basically fill up the entire space under it and threaten to come over. Dredging out underneath it would be the obvious solution, or building a new bridge. But it's pretty challenging, you know, and sort of in the same context the rest of this dredging. It's challenging to get permits and permission from all the different agencies to do dredging work. The city's certainly interested in pursuing that.
Roger Anderson, Morro Bay. Along that same line, I was pleased, but not sure I'm in agreement that the suggestion that 100-year floods will carry sediment out of the harbor and scour the channel. The example that was just discussed, you know, the fire, of course, denuded the hillsides, but there was a heavy rain year, and instead of being carried out to sea, it was deposited in the bottom of the bay. When I was a child, I have five decades of personal experience here, plus the oral history from my family. You know, a hook turn channel doesn't seem to be as effective at scouring as a rather straight line that originally existed. When I was a child, you couldn't reach up and touch the bottom, and I got to witness the Twin Bridges Dam rather than the Twin Bridges channels. And so observation tells me that sediment is being left in the bay rather than carried out to sea. I've watched the carrying capacity of the bay being reduced in my lifetime. I question the claim that it's going to be carried out to sea, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's clear that some sediment is always, sediment's moving in and out of the bay, and in storm events, some of it leaves the system, and on regular events, and in fact, when there's no storm, sometimes the wind churns up sediment that gets carried out. I think I agree with you, basically. The Army Corps' model was saying that sediment was going to settle out in the channels. I think some of it's a semantic confusion that they were talking about the larger channels in the bay versus in the creek. It's definitely filling in under Twin Bridges. It's readily apparent. I think the channels in the bay maybe do seem to be scouring and getting deeper for the most part, the narrow channels, while the rest of the mudflats come up. But I think the bottom line is it's obvious that the channels are accumulating a lot of sediment in the creeks. In the bay itself, the bay is definitely getting shallower. I think some of the channel network seems to be maintaining its depth or even getting deeper.
Is there ever any thought about changing around the rock, doing restoration work around the rock, but open that other side back up?
The question was whether anyone has looked at opening up the sort of pre-causeway situation at the mouth of the harbor so that the channel, sort of the native channel before anyone messed with it, was the rock was an island and there was water flowing in and out on both sides of it. That's a question we've gotten a lot, and the Army Corps did a very cursory look at that And, you know, their sort of engineers kind of on the back of the envelope said, wow, that doesn't look like a very good idea to us. I think, you know, my first reaction is I'm a surfer around here, and we get 20-foot northwest swells in the wintertime with some regularity. If there wasn't a causeway there, I think there'd be 20-foot swells rolling into the Embarcadero, which wouldn't be very good for a lot of businesses down there. And so from sort of just a navigation, I think the City Harbor Department would be pretty concerned about opening up the north side of the rock. From a sediment point of view, I don't think we really know what it would do. Although you can sort of guess if you look at a lot of natural lagoons, if there wasn't a big dredged channel entrance, sediment might actually be accumulating more rapidly in the bay because we have this artificially maintained large volume channel that's maintained that allows a lot of water to flush in and out of the bay, where if we didn't dredge that, it would get pretty shallow. It would probably bar up almost in the summertime, and so it might have less capacity for sediment to get carried out of the bay. But that's guessing. Jeff could probably make a more educated guess than me about that.
Mark Schulman, you kind of preempted my question, but, you know, we've talked about the major changes that have taken place in the last 130 years, you know, most of them mentioned were all upstream, and it seems to me the major event that changed the bay was the building of the causeway. And it's kind of a moot point now because it's there, and like you say, you know, if you were to restore the original situation, which had the bay flowing out on both sides of the rock and neither of the jetties, you know, not only would you have 20-foot swells rolling right up the Embarcadero, but effectively you'd no longer have, you know, a usable harbor entrance. But, you know, I think, like so many of the other things that have been done by the Army Corps of Engineers, you know, the unintended consequence down the line, and certainly they're trying to improve things, but I've lived in California for 50 years, grew up in Newport Beach, and, you know, they build one jetty, and then having to stud the entire coastline with jetties to keep all the sand from moving, you know, out to sea because of, again, this unintended consequence. But I really wonder what the picture in the bay would be like if we didn't have the, you know, the current channel configuration. Of course, we probably wouldn't have the harbor in Morro Bay either. But, you know, I wonder what the choke point, you know, at the area where the tidal flow leaves the bay and goes into the ocean. I mean, that it's probably had a pretty major effect on what's happened in the rest of the bay, I would think. But there's really no way of knowing.
I think we could spend a lot of money to pay someone to build really sophisticated models of that, but my experience so far with that sort of enterprise is that we'd be better off to just ask some smart people to take their best stab at it, and because, as you said, it's a little bit of a moot point. It's definitely an interesting question, though.
Hi, Alon Perlman from Los Osos. I have two questions, completely separate. One is that in terms of the bathymetry, it does look like you're very close, but the very important zone is actually that edge point, the eelgrass survival zone, and that's the part that's least mapped. Shouldn't it be fairly easy if you got a program with possibly robotics that would be able to map those areas, shallow draft robots, maybe even random walks with a GPS that goes on right now? You actually don't have to even program it to go to any particular spot. It could just paddle around solar powered. So that's just a technological suggestion. I'm very much an advocate for restoring the traditional pathway. As far as the swells are concerned, that intuitively your model doesn't look right. This bay is, I'm not this model, what I mean is a model of deposition just doesn't intuitively look right to me or to apparently other people. It's obviously not matching observations. So I would have to just say that, like hurricane models, you need, not you, but a better model would be needed. If a better model exists and can be sustained, and that's a Cal Poly thing with with water tanks and models that actually have contour maps to them and have maybe selected finds placed in there, then the model can be used to predict what would happen. With a powerful model like that, you could actually start looking at what could be done to separate the rock from the shore and still shield, say, Morro Bay from swells, et cetera, and generate a little bit more movement. So I hope maybe usually the models today are pretty much on. Another thing is that there's, I think what's missing in the model is sorry for taking so long, but it's not really modeling chaos and eddies. And that's the part that's missing. There's a lot of development in that science, and you're not really capturing where the finer sediment in your model is probably not really getting captured as a unit. So if you could address that, I know it's not a question.
No, I think you're right that turbulence is a very challenging thing to model, and the way that water flows or air moves is really challenging to model. As far as the eelgrass, I'll just say that we do have a partnership with NOAA Fisheries, who are very interested in eelgrass for its habitat value to fish, and they are coming up here and did last year as well, gosh, in a couple weeks, and with a side scan sonar on their boat, and going to be making a whole bunch of runs across the eelgrass beds that we're going to be using to ground truth the kind of data we can get from aerial imagery. So that is helping us to capture the subtidal areas. And we do also have some fixed transects. We're not really talking about our eelgrass monitoring program in our agenda for this conference, but we have a pretty extensive program. We do have fixed transects out there where we actually get out on the mudflats and slog around, try not to get stuck, and measure the actual shoot densities at fixed points, and then compare that to aerial imagery, compare it to the boats going overhead with their sonar equipment on it. So I think we are actually able to get at most of the eelgrass in the bay.
Yeah.
Please.
I did want to respond just a little bit because about some of the comments about the construction of the causeway and the effects of that and possibly on sedimentation processes. And one of the things that when we first started looking at the historic maps and started looking at the bay in the mid-'80s, we were wondering if the closing off of one side of that rock had affected tidal circulation in the bay. And so one of the very first things I did out here was get a whole group of stakeholders just like you to come out and sit for an entire tidal cycle for 25 hours, and we had a series of 5 tidal stations throughout the bay, and we monitored those for a 25-hour period. And what we found was that the bay gets absolutely complete tidal circulation all the way to the end of the bay throughout it, both in terms of amplitude and timing, that there's a lag as you get to the back bay in the tide, but there's not a damping of it, and the water is not appreciably slowed down. And when you look back in some of the historical records of why they built the causeway, basically, in addition to, in terms of trying to make this a navigable harbor, there was an issue of waves, and there still are some fairly famous sleeper waves, or whatever they call them, that can form off of there. But what they were trying to do by doing that was that when the full tidal prism comes out of the bay, it's concentrated in that one channel. So it has maximum scour potential on the ebb tide in the dredged channel. And the idea of that was to reduce the amount of dredging that they would have to do to keep this channel open. And when I did my early work on this on the bay in 86, I looked at there are relationships between tidal prism versus open ocean wave power, and you can predict how big the channel wants to be. And the Morro Bay channel wants to be a heck of a lot smaller than it's dredged at right now. So if you stop the dredging program today, this channel would tend to silt in pretty dramatically over time. And if you opened up the other side, it would actually silt in even quicker. Because basically, you're spreading that erosive power of the water out. And so my conclusion in general is that, I mean, actually, they at one point were looking, the Corps was looking at not funding dredging anymore for the small harbors like Noyo, Elkhorn Slough, Moss Landing Harbor, and some of those. And Morro Bay would become practically unusable as a harbor, I think, over a period of time if you stopped the dredging program. And also, it's not really affecting the deposition in the Back Bay. What's happening in the Back Bay is really a result of changes in the watershed and the increase in sediment coming down. And that silt, very fine-grained silt, is going to settle out in the bay regardless of whether you have one or two openings. So I think I'm not saying that there aren't issues of related to that, but it would not appreciably change the sedimentation and life of the bay if you opened up both of these, would be my guess. Yeah.
Yeah, I have two comments. Dave Akey, Los Osos. Yeah. I also have a boat in Morro Bay. And my first comment is, could not the causeway be opened up in such a way that would block rogue waves or for storm waves? And the second part of that is, how much real consideration has been given to using tidal floodgates in the south part of the bay going across the sand spit? Would that not be more economical by far than to try to do something on the north side? Thank you.
Do you want to comment? Okay.
Opening up another entrance to the bay was looked at sort of at a very, again, kind of back of the envelope. It was on the list when we were working with the Army Corps kind of back in 2002 and 2003. So I don't have the right image up here, but we talked about, there's kind of two things you could do. Well, there's infinite things you could do, but you could either dig a tunnel, in theory, underneath the sand spit, a culvert under the sand spit, to have tidal flow moving in and out, or you could actually cut another entrance to the bay back here. And the problem is that both things would get plugged with sand and silt almost immediately, I think. There's also sort of the environmental impact of doing it, which certainly is no more than some kind of big dredging operation. We basically tossed those out early on, and I think that I don't really see either of them as being very feasible. I think that and also sort of don't appeal to me very much from a restoration point of view, because you're not going back to any sort of previous state. You're trying to engineer some new solution. I've heard, I'd be interested to hear from you guys, various times I've heard this rumor essentially that at one point Shark Inlet was open. I still don't know that that was ever true. That's more than a rumor, and I don't actually think it is more than a rumor, unless somebody has seen it open or knows, open to the sea. Yeah, I don't think that was ever the case. I mean, at one point there was no sand spit, there was probably all kinds of configurations, but not any time in the last hundreds, if not thousand or more years.
In response to that comment, I think that you have to consider that Morro Bay is already an artificial situation, and what restoration you can do has to be tempered with that fact by the actual dredging that's been done to keep with the causeway and the dredging that keeps the mouth open. And what data is there? Could you elaborate, please, on why that buried or tunnel type of tidal gate would silt in immediately? Thanks.
There was not a detailed sort of modeling exercise of what would happen if you did that. I think it was more the coastal engineers at the Army Corps who do this for a living and model shorelines and come up with ideas up and down the coast said, we don't really see that as being a real solution. I guess, and if you just try and picture it, do you put a drain? I mean, is it like a storm drain in the middle of the Back Bay that goes down and out? I can't even really imagine it very clearly, and maybe that's my lack of imagination. But okay. I guess the short answer is we don't have a detailed sort of modeling, what if we did this, look at that. It was much more of a expert opinion said, don't go farther down this road.
John Flaherty from Los Osos. And actually, I've heard that as well, that the Shark Inlet end of the bay was open. And I think that goes back to historical data from Father Crespi from the Portola expedition, describing the bay. He sees the rock, a sand spit in front, and they were camped right about in the Choro Delta area. And then you saw open ocean down toward the left. So that's maybe the source of the rumor. Whether or not that's actually true or not is another question. But I actually did have a regular question. This is for you, Jeff, I believe, most directly. And I was wondering, when you had the model about the bay filling in at somewhere between 400 and 1,000 years, and then you had another graph that showed with relatively aggressive approaches to stopping the sediment from coming into the bay, 25%, 50%, 75%. Is there any sense from the data that's been gathered in the last, let's say, 10 or 15 years, particularly since the Chortle Flats project, where we are in terms of one of those models, 25%, 50%, 75%? How successful have we been in the last 10 years in terms of stopping sediment from coming into the bay?
Jeff, yeah.
I have not done any monitoring, and really, I think the closest thing that came to an attempt at monitoring effectiveness was the paired watersheds program that Cal Poly was running for a while, where they were trying to measure sediment in Choro Creek and in some of the tributaries and trying to see the benefits of their actions. But it turns out to be very difficult to measure sediment and sediment changes as a result of your restoration activities. And, you know, I think what happens is you can sort of heuristically say, well, if we revegetate an area, some of the work that Dan showed up in Walters Creek and stuff, you know inherently that you're reducing the amount of sediment from that particular spot. But And this really applies to the core modeling and to some of the other things that you've seen. One of the things is we're reasonably good at modeling the flow of water, but we're not great at it. And sediment is about 10 times harder to predict in terms of modeling and deposition and erosion and stuff like that. So it is very difficult to actually quantify. You know, you keep thinking to yourself, well, I could just go out in Choro Creek and take a water sample and see how clear it is, and then over a period of time it should be getting clearer if we're successful. But sediment movement is so episodic, and so that 1995 event may represent 90% of the sediment that's moved in that system over the last 25 years. It may have all happened in 1 or 2 days, and to actually say, well, would that have been different if we hadn't done Choro Flats? I know we trapped, volume-wise, we trapped about 250,000 yards, I believe, of sediment on Choro Flats during that event. And the other estimates I've heard is that there was something on the order of 900,000 yards that went into the bay over that period, some of which dropped out at Twin Bridges. And I have to say, when the city built Twin Bridges, they could have been much more thoughtful about it. It was difficult. I mean, in all fairness to them, you know, the higher you make a bridge, the approaches and everything, it gets a lot harder to do. You just think, well, we should have gone up, you know, 25 feet, and then you'd be fine. Well, to get up 25 feet, you have to go back a mile on either side and rebuild the road. So, you know, you're trying to decide how much. But I never felt like, you know, that was carefully enough studied at what elevation they should build at. But that regardless, you know, you make your best judgments when you're a municipality and do those things. But the reality is I think Choro Flats captured about 20 to 30% of the sediment that was coming down Choro Creek that particular episode. But longer term, it's very hard to know that, and that's why some of the stuff that Dean was talking about is really exciting, because the only way you really know that you're being successful is the bay doesn't fill in. And so ultimately, you know, measuring the bay itself is probably the most accurate way to do that. But it's on the order of decades and multiple decades that you're going to see that. So it's, you know, it's a little bit of it is based on faith. You say, hey, we're going to do all this work in the watershed because we know it's good for the watershed. But exactly percentage-wise, it's very hard to measure. So, I mean, that's kind of a squirrely answer, but it's the truth.
I'm Dave Bolas from Los Osos, and I have a question about the modeling. We've been hearing about modeling and back of envelopes and stuff like that, and a previous questioner asked about tanks, you know, flowing water through tanks and dumping in sediment. What models work, and what are they? I know in San Francisco they have some kind of a whole bay model, but is that anything that is of any use, or what actually is done when you're trying to model what happens in a bay?
Well, I tried to show you that one slide up early on in the beginning when I talked about the time frame of different processes. And so one of the things that's always difficult is that when you run a hydrodynamic model of the bay, which is one that predicts the flow in and around the bay, it's run on a time step of seconds. and then you run that for a period of a week or a month or something, and you get some understanding of the currents, and then you try to put sediment into that model and predict when it will fall out and when it won't. But really, what you're looking at in the bay is the accumulation of sediment during many events over many decades, and making those leaps from one time frame to the next is very difficult. The point you made about the San Francisco Bay model is that because hydrodynamics are very complicated, and one of the earlier questioners raised the issue of eddies and turbulence and things like that, is that because of that complexity and the fact that computers weren't all that great not that long ago, we used to build physical models of the systems. And so up in San Francisco Bay, we have a model of the bay that takes up about 2 acres. And it's in housed in a great big building, and it's actually a little physical model of the bay. And then you introduce water at the Golden Gate Bridge, and it flows, and you have a complete recreation of the bay. And then you have little sensors, and you can measure velocities and things like that at any point in the bay. So that was used to evaluate projects between about 1950 and 1975 or 80 or so. It turns out to be very difficult and complicated, and since then, the computer models have gotten a lot better. So almost nobody builds physical models of whole systems anymore. They still do for some individual structures and things. But computer models have gotten better and better. But I would say they're still very poor at predicting geomorphic changes, the changes that take place over decades or centuries. And so from that's why we try to use multiple lines of evidence for doing things. But I don't think there's anybody that says right today we have a great model of the watershed that tells you exactly how much sediment we're going to get in any given rain year. We learn more by looking at the average over many years and saying, well, this is kind of the range that we can see and stuff. So, but I think some of the most exciting stuff is actually happening in the area of data collection, and I do see changes occurring, you know, improvements in our ability to measure changes and measure the amount of sediment coming out of the watershed. I think that will improve a lot in the coming years.
We're going to take one more question and then have a force you guys to stop asking questions and have a lunch break, because we want everyone to be back here at 1.
Do I get my question?
You get your question.
Okay. My name is Don Parham, and I live in Baywood Park. One thing that I feel we should remember, that is that we don't want to make the bay into an artificial swimming pool. And you get an extensive dredging program going there. You'll have to have money to take care of that on forever. So that really the direction that we have to go is the direction I think that this program's indicates that we are on, and that is find what's happening in the bay now naturally and see if we can do anything to augment what it wants to do itself. And if we that's about all we can really do that will extend the life of the bay without making it into an artificial swimming pool, and I think that would be a terrible mistake.
Thank you. I think you raised an important point that I didn't talk about, which is when you think about working in the watershed versus or trapping sediment by restoring the natural function of the streams and wetlands versus a dredging program, you know, and Jeff mentioned this, the work in the watershed has a lot of other benefits that are valuable in their own right. Even if the bay is not filling in, it's the right way to manage the land, whereas the work in the bay, it's a one-time thing. You go in, you dredge the bay. If you don't fix the problem, you know, it's sort of like doing liposuction and not changing your diet. I think to steal a phrase, and the bay, it's just going to fill back in. So you're going to keep digging it out. You know, are you going to keep doing this over and over, or are you going to get the root of the problem? So I think that's an important point. I mean, if we restored the depths of the bay with a big dredging operation and didn't do anything upstream, we'd be in the same place again in 100 years. And with that, we're going to break for lunch. Thank you guys so much for your interest.